All right, here we go. Okay, so the section of Amalek, you know, we have an obligation, which we'll hear about soon, about waging war with Amalek. It is seen and described by many as one of the most complicated mitzvah that exists, okay? So before we get to the mitzvah itself, the commandment itself, let's appreciate the context, and then we'll try to bring it to the mitzvah, then hopefully walk away with some modern applications as well. Okay, so this passage picks up where the Jewish people had just left Mitzrayim. We don't know exactly how many days, but not too many days, because we know this is still before the receiving of the Torah, which was 49 days later. So this is somewhere between 7, day 7 or 8 and day 49. Somewhere in between those two, okay? Or day 45 probably, okay? So the Jewish people had just left Egypt, okay? And the Torah tells us, Vayavo Amalek, Amalek came, Vayelachim im Yisrael birfidim, and they waged war in Rephidim. Okay, now when we see they're waging war, we have to immediately ask ourselves a very basic question. Why do they attack the Jewish people? Why is it that Amalek attacks the Jewish people? And as Jews, we always come back as traditions, you know, from our tradition, we always address the question on two levels, two angles. One is perhaps the practical, you know, what was Amalek thinking? The other is the introspective perspective, where we ask ourselves, what did we do to deserve it? Those two are not mutually exclusive, right? There could be a very rational explanation explaining scientific reason, and there could also be some explanation which is very much about our own behavior or misbehavior. And so our sages do suggest that that if you look at the sections immediately before this, the Jewish people demonstrate a lack of faith. You know, it's a pretty amazing thing on the one hand, because they just experienced and witnessed 10 amazing plagues. They witnessed the splitting of the sea. But as the Rambam, Maimonides, tells us, miracles, despite the fact that we always say, if I'd see a miracle, you know, I would, doesn't really work that way. You know, we've all had our big highs, and then we kind of revert back to our regular, right? It takes a lot of small steps, a lot of, you know, of inner work, and those big flashes of inspiration don't necessarily have that impact, and that's exactly what we watch. The Jewish people throughout the desert, and immediately after the splitting of the sea, they complain a lot. Some of the complaints are seen as legitimate, some of them are seen as illegitimate, and one of the questions they ask in the passage immediately before this is God even with us? Is God even with us? It's a crazy question, right? There's a cloud of glory, there's a fire, okay. But they ask the question, is God even with us? So our sages say that God wanted to show them what it means for God not to be there, and all of a sudden they become exposed, and this kind of invites the Amalekim to go ahead and attack them. Okay, so this is taking it from the perspective, the moral perspective. Like, what did we do wrong? We have to introspect. When something bad happens to us, it is incumbent upon us to ask ourselves, what is there something that we could be doing better? And that's our sages' perspective. That said, what about from Amalek's perspective? Like, what was driving them? What was driving them? Okay, so the commentators do point out, if you look, the first word, Vayavo Amalek. Amalek came. Where did they come from? And the commentators point out that if you look at a map, which I don't have in front of us, Amalek is nowhere near Rephidim. They are right now in a place called Rephidim. The place where Amalek typically lives, which we hear about later on in the book of Shmuel, is quite far away. So it seems like they actually made quite a journey to go ahead and attack the Jewish people, which already gives us some insight about the fact that these people have it against us. It wasn't a typical defensive war, right? It wasn't, you know, when we have people defending themselves, we could understand that, we could justify it. Of course, they want to defend themselves. You know, we'll defend ourselves as well. But over here, Amalek was not threatened in any way. They travel quite a distance, and they go ahead and they attack the Jewish people. The Barbanel suggests that they assume the Jewish people had just left Egypt. They're a group of ragtag slaves, and they were just completely unprepared. So basically, they were assuming this was a vulnerable moment. Yes, they had all those great miracles, but this was a vulnerable moment, and they could therefore go ahead and attack and just take care of the Jewish people. But it wasn't coming from, again, I want to be so strongly emphasized, this wasn't a defensive war. This was seen across the board by all of our commentators as some moral war. They saw the Jewish people as in some way an embodiment of this new order of morality, of a God who runs the world, of a God who cares about individuals, of all the lessons that we're supposed to learn from the Exodus, from Yetzias Mitzrayim. And they said, I don't want those messages. I have to show, even if I'm not going to be successful, I have to show that the Jewish people are invincible. You know, the parable that our sages give is they describe a boiling hot tub. A boiling hot tub, and everyone's afraid to go in the tub. Everyone's afraid to go in. There's a mikvah in a men's mikvah in Mei Sha'arim, where there are three baths. Okay, and there's one which is like coldish. There's one which is like hot. Okay, there's one which is warm. There's one that's hot. And there's one which is like steam is going everywhere. I remember I was once there watching this like really, really. And everyone's afraid. Like they had a certain time, like on Friday afternoon, that's when like the hottest temperature possible, right? And basically people go before Shabbos. I remember watching this one like really, really old man. Like somehow like he must have like lost all the senses in his body at this point. So he was just like able to walk in. But everyone else kind of watching gingerly putting their toe in, you know, afraid. Bottom line is, right? But when you see one person do it, then you say, oh, I guess I could do it, right? That so basically Amalek, they didn't think they were even going to win. But they didn't like what the Jewish people represented. So therefore travel this great distance. They go and attack, even though they know there's no way they're going to defeat this army, which is defended by God. And therefore they go and they just want to show that they are not invincible, that the Jews. So it's a moral war. It's a war that they don't like what the Jewish people represent. Okay? Let's keep on reading. So Vayomer Moshe El Yoshua. Moshe turns to Yeshua and says, "Bechar lanu anashim, choose for us people." Okay, our commentators actually learn Gemara. The Talmud actually learns from here that you look at the way he speaks to Yeshua. Isn't this beautiful? It's such a humble way of speaking. He doesn't say, "Go choose people for me," right? He says, "Bechar lanu anashim." Yeshua, Joshua is the student. Moshe is the leader, and he speaks in this very, I guess we'll use egalitarian type of way. Like he lowers himself and he says, choose for us people, right? And our commentators actually learn from here the respect that a teacher has to have for their students. It isn't this, we don't believe, yes, there is a teacher and there is a student, but there is a sense of being together that has to be presented as well, okay? Vitzei hi lachem ba'malek and go wage war against Amalek. Machar, tomorrow, anochi nitzav arosha giva, I'm going to stand on the top of the mountain. Umate helokim biadi. And the stick of God is going to be in my hand. Okay, so why does Moshe not wage war himself? Right? We know later on, Moshe goes ahead and wages war. It's interesting that he goes and appoints someone else to be the general over here. So again, the Barbanel suggests that Moshe recognized that this war was a war that was due to their sins, and therefore recognized the primacy. What's most important is prayer, is tefillah. And therefore he took the most important job for himself, to pray, and then he went ahead and set up Yeshua as the one who was going to wage war. As Jews, we believe, right, there's this balance. Of course, we need to fight, so there's no notion of like just, you know, God is going to save us. But at the same time, Moshe recognized, especially since it was in response to their sins, Moshe was going to pray, and Yeshua is going to fight. Okay, the commentators do point out that it was specifically Yeshua because Yeshua comes from the tribe of Ephraim. This is a little mystical, but Yeshua comes from the tribe of Ephraim, and Amalek comes from the family of Esav, and we know there's a messianic war between the family of Esav and what is known as Mashiach ben Yosef, a messianic figure coming from the tribe of Yosef, and therefore Moshe intuitively understood that it was not him, it was Yeshua. Out of all the Jews, he was the one coming from the tribe of Yosef that should go and wage that war. Okay, fine. Why is Moshe up on the mountain praying? Okay, so very simply, he wants to inspire the fighters. There's going to be a fight underneath. And Moshe, and the truth is, you look at some ancient warfare, and sometimes you'll find like the kings will stand up high with their, you know, with their stallion, and they'll sit there with their, you know, and they're safe. No one touches the king, whatever it is. But it's meant to be an inspiration to everyone else. Like, similarly over here, Moshe's up on the mountain. He's praying. They see him praying. And in doing so, that inspires the people to do the same. Okay.
Don't you see that in Israel, there's groups that will not fight?
Yes.
Is this where they got it from?
I wouldn't say so. Well, no, because in this passage, we do find Moshe, yes and no, right? There's a recognition that someone has to fight. There's no notion, but there's also, we certainly have a long-standing tradition that some people will be focused on prayer, some people will be focused on study, and some people need to fight. So in some ways, yes, it is born out of this. But again, there has to be a recognition that there's also people have to fight. And if people are not, you know, and how many people are meant to study and pray? And how many people are meant to wage war? That's a complicated question.
A lot of Jews are against.
Correct,
against,
correct.
So against our own selves, which is very sad.
Correct, correct. So to say that no one should be studying and no one should be praying, that would also not be our way. But what we don't have clarity, I think, practically speaking, is how many people and who, those are complicated questions. But generally speaking, the value in ensuring that there are people who are praying during war, that there are people studying nonstop during war, 100% that we believe, you know, we said this morning, you know, we say typically every morning that, you know, that they, Elev Erechav, Elev Asusim, that the enemies of the Jews, they come in their chariots and their horses, like in this week's Parsha, V'anachnu b'shem Hashem Elokeinu Nazkir, and we come with the name of God. Yeah, we also have our horses, but we don't put our faith in that. We put our faith in prayer, and we need both. Yeah. Okay. Vayas Yoshua, Kasher Amar Lo Moshe, and Yoshua did as Yoshua, as Moshe said, Li Lachim Bamalik, to fight war against the Malik. Moshe, Aaron, Vechur, Alu, Rosh HaGivan. Moshe, Aaron, and Chur went to the top of the mountain. Vahaya, and it was, Kasher Yarim Moshe Yado, Vigavar Yisrael. When Moshe raised his hands, the Jewish people were victorious. Vechashir Yaniach Yado, Vigavar Amalik. When he lowered his hands, then Amalik overpowered. Now, this is obviously very troubling. Are Moshe's hands magical? Like, what exactly is going on over here? So there's two, right? Strange. Puts his hand up, we win. It almost sounds like a magic trick, right? He puts his hands up, they win. Puts his hands down, they lose. So what's going on? So the Ralbag suggests that what's going on over here is that Moshe wanted to teach the people that when he ceased to pray, when he paused in his prayer, all of a sudden they start losing, right? Moshe was trying to educate them over here. And, you know, sometimes the way we teach, you know, you ever teach a child how to ride a bike, right? You don't hold on all the time. You leave, go. You gotta learn. Young parents are not so good at this. This generation is not so good at it. Certainly, yeah. Anyway, but the bottom line is that's what Moshe's doing. Moshe's saying, I raise my hands in tefillah. Look, we're winning. I put my hands lower and we're losing, right? Because again, where did this all come from? This came from the Jewish people saying, is God really with us? And the answer is, yeah. Yeah, when we turn to him, he's with us. When we don't turn to him, he's not. And that's how some understand this. The Chasam Sofer suggests that what's happening is the Jewish people are actually, there are those who are waging war, and there are many others who were imitating Moshe, copying Moshe, and also davening when Moshe was davening. And so whenever he, so to speak, took a break, it wasn't just Moshe raising his hands, it was Moshe raising his hands in prayer. All the Jews raised their hands in prayer. And whenever that stopped and paused, right, a war is not a 10-minute thing, it goes on and on and on. Whenever there was a pause in the prayer, that's when you could immediately see a change in the warfare. Okay. Videi Moshe kvedim, Moshe's hands were literally heavy. Vayikhu evet v'yisimu tachtav, they placed a stone under him. Vayeshev ala, and he sat on it. V'aron v'chur tamchu v'yadav, and Aaron and Chur held onto his hands. Mizeachad, mizeachad. Vayhi yadav emuna ad bo hashemesh, and his hands were like consistent until the sun, until the sun came up. Now, what is the significance of this? That his hands are heavy, he needs people to hold him up. So I think the most practical way of understanding this is, of course, you know, people sometimes are ill and they come to shul and they want to stand for Shmoneh Esrei. You don't have to stand. Like, you know, it's okay. Like, if you can't raise your hands, you would be able to continue praying. You know, it'd be hard to imagine holding your hands for like an hour, right? Try doing it for 2 hours, 3 hours, for a whole day. It's not easy, right? So of course it makes sense that Moshe is lowering his hands. But the commentators understood that it was important that Moshe raised his hands more for the morale of the people than for what it is, right? What's it called? You know, like sometimes you'll find people pushing themselves a way of boosting the morale of everyone around them, even if they themselves are not necessarily fully capable. I'm blanking. Sorry, I'm Canadian. Who was the president during World War II in the wheelchair? FDR, right? Yeah. Okay. So, sorry. Excuse my ignorance. Okay. But right. But he's wheelchair bound, right? But he would oftentimes push himself, and even if he was extremely like beaten down and weak, he would put on this incredibly brave and strong face, and oftentimes hide his wheelchair even. You know, not that something to be embarrassed about. The point is that it was a way of demonstrating a certain sense of strength. And similarly, Moshe over here wants to show them that his hands are up, even though at one point it was taxing, it was necessary for him to hold up his hands. Okay. Vayachalosh Yoshua Samalik v'samol l'ficharev, and Yoshua was successful in weakening Amalek by sword. Okay. Vayomer Hashem, and God says now, K'sov zos zikar masefer, write what took place in the book. V'simba aznei Yeshua, and placed in the ears of Yeshua, ki macho emche es zecher Amalek mitachas shemayim, I will completely obliterate the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. Now, these are the strongest words we find in the context of any enemy of the Jewish people. And it doesn't go into detail, but we will come back to those details shortly. But it says we'll completely obliterate Amalek. We don't, you know, the other enemies will wage war over here. We'll completely obliterate Amalek. We'll come back to that. Vayivem Moshe Mizbech v'yikrashmo Hashem Nisi. And Moshe built an altar and he called it Hashem is my miracle. Vayomer ki yad al kesia, when there is a hand on the throne of God. Melchama l'Hashem ba'amalek midor dor, a war against God with Amalek, okay, from generation to generation. So how do you read that verse? The way that the Das Zakenim understand is that when Amalek placed their hands on God's throne, what does it mean to place your hand on God's throne? Again, let's go back to the beginning of the story. Amalek recognizes that God is looking good in the world. 10 plagues, splitting of the sea. Everyone's like, ah, they're the hot bath. They're untouchable, right? And basically, Amalek says, no, I have a handle. I can hold on to it. I'm waging war against God. So it was a war against God. Amalek means Zardar. And there's a war that we're going to have. That there's going to be some semblance of this war from generation to generation. It's not necessarily, as we'll see, Amalek, you know, throughout. But there will be other people there'll be other nations that perhaps represent this idea that there'll be those who try to get in the way of the positive image of God in the world, monotheism, all the positive that comes with it. And there's this war, this generation war against Amalek. Okay, that's the end of the passage. And now, yes,
Dina. I have a question. So when it says that he made Amalek weak, he didn't say that he would wipe them out or he was successful in getting rid of them. It's just that he weakened them. What does that mean?
That means he weakened them. He was not successful in completely routing them. That means that. Correct. They weren't, right? We know that they weren't wiped out at all, right? We know that the war continues in the times of Shaul and then again in David HaMelech. The war continues over and over and over again until a time when I'm just gonna pass these out. Can you grab these? Sorry. Yeah, thank you. Okay. So what I want to get into a little bit again is I want to do first just to see the passage, right? One thing we just saw very clearly from Amalek is the sense of evil from Amalek is that they fought for no practical reason. It was more of like there's no defense. There's nothing that they were defending. B, there's no warning. There's no warning. You know, when the Jewish people go and attack in the land of Israel, not just in modern times, which they certainly do, but even in the times of the conquest of Canaan, they would warn. They would actually offer peace treaties, which we'll be reading about in a moment. So Amalek doesn't do that. The other thing, which we don't see over here, but we'll see in a passage, not today, but a passage in Devarim, is that they didn't just attack the Jewish people head on. They actually, they're stragglers. They're people, anechalashim, those who are weak, those who they attacked. So you see like an incredible amount of like immorality of Amalek. Again, there's no real personal gain over here. They're going ahead and they're fighting in a way which was like not even in line with the rules of engagement of the ancient world. And that gives us a little bit of a picture of Amalek, but still, and this is what we're going to focus on now, you know, many are bothered by the fact that, okay, they broke every rule of engagement, granted, or they cooled a boiling bath, as we saw. But does that justify going ahead and wiping out an entire nation? Question, right? And the modern term, what is the modern term we'll use for that? Genocide, right? This is the term genocide, as you're wiping out an entire nation. Would we say that's enough to therefore say that this entire nation should be obliterated? Thoughts? I don't know.
Well, it says Hashem says that he's going to maintain the war against Amalek from generation to generation. It seems like it's never over. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, the command is to wipe it out, that mount. But on the other hand, says from generation to generation, maintain the war.
Right. Okay, it's a very good point. There's certainly something there. On the one hand, we're being told that it's we're given certain instructions, and at the same time, it's also, I think, one of the other pieces you mentioned is that it's God's war. Like, there's a sense of God is fighting against them. If you look historically, you know, when do the Jewish people attack Amalek? Only after they're instructed to do so, right? So, and meaning by a prophet.
Only after they've been attacked themselves.
Well, yes and no, sort of. It's a little unclear. Meaning, the next time they attack Amalek that we see explicitly is in the book of Shmuel. And we're not going to do a deep dive into Shmuel, but if you look at the text over there, it does seem clear that they were seen as part of the enemies of the Jewish people. So we don't know of all the little fights that are taking place and the attacks that might be taking place, but it does seem like Amalek is not just a random neighbor that's like a peaceful ally and that they're attacking. It does seem like they are they were attacking, although there's no explicit mention of the fact they're attacking. What I was mentioning was the fact that the only time that we find the Jewish people attacking Amalek is when there's a prophet who is given an explicit message: go fight Amalek. Okay, as opposed to someone getting up and saying, hey, we got to kill Amalek, right? And we'll see that point of how we're supposed to, attack Amalek is a matter of much debate amongst the medieval commentators. If you look under the Sefer HaChinuch is just a fascinating book. I love the story behind the book. The Sefer HaChinuch was written by an anonymous author. We don't know who wrote it. It was written in the Middle Ages. And he wrote this book. He writes an introduction that he wrote this book because his son was kind of bored on Shabbos. And was just like playing around. And he wanted to give him something which was learning, but a little bit more enjoyable, right? You know, it's Shabbos. It shouldn't be like, you know, it shouldn't be hard for kids sometimes to study. And so he wrote this book all about the mitzvos in the Torah. I don't know if as a 13-year-old I could sit through reading it, but whatever. I guess he had a good son. And, you know, instead of playing ball, he had this book It's a beautiful thing. I don't know. I'm always very moved by the story behind the book. Anyway, so in the Sefer HaChinuch, right, the book of, literally, of education, right, he writes, and the truth in truth, in truth, is it that the obligation to kill them and destroy them from the world is also incumbent upon every male individual from Israel if they have the power in their hands in every place and at all times if he finds one from all of their seed. So the Sefer HaChinuch says the mitzvah of destroying Amalek is incumbent upon every single person, every Jew. He said it's a time-bound mitzvah maybe, so that's why it's males. But the point is that if you find someone, if you do, what's it called, 23andMe, right, the DNA things, right, and they find out that they have Amalek blood, a Jew would have the right and obligation, according to the Sefer HaChinuch, to go ahead and kill that person. Okay? Let's see what the Rambam writes. We'll see if they're disagreeing or not. Says the Rambam, war is not conducted against anyone in the world until they are first offered peace, and then they refuse it. Whether this is a discretionary war or a war of mitzvah. What he means by that is that there's a war of mitzvah, meaning the conquering of the land of Canaan in ancient times was seen as a milchemet mitzvah. They were obligated. God said, go conquer the land of Canaan. But what we don't know, what the Rambam holds, it's a debate, but the Rambam holds is that that they would first send out a peace treaty saying, do you want to live in the land? If you do, great. You have to follow the basic moral code, what we call the Noahide laws, Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. And if so, we'll live side by side, right? Okay, so he says, however, with one of the seven nations, or with Amalek, who do not make peace, we leave no soul alive. As it says, so you shall do with everyone, only of the cities of the nations, do not leave any soul. And regarding Amalek, it says, erase the memory of Amalek. How do we know? This is referring to those who do not make peace with us, for it says, there was no city which came to peace with the children of Israel, except the Chivites, dwellers of Givon. Okay, so basically the Rambam infers from a pasuk in, pasuk in Nevi'im, that they did send peace treaties to every single one of the nations, including Amalek. Okay, so what's the difference between Amalek, the seven nations living in Canaan, and all other nations? He says there's no difference between Amalek and the seven nations. Okay, what that means is that, just practically, when Yeshua was coming to the land of Israel, they would send letters. And they'd say, if you want to make peace, if you want to keep the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, great, you could stay here. If they refused, then with those nations, they would wipe them out completely. It seems like God is saying, all those nations, not just Amalek, there's no distinction between Amalek and other nations according to the Rambam, all those nations were seen as something about them, that if they didn't make peace, by make peace means they didn't agree to keep the Noahide laws, then they'd be completely wiped out. Whereas other nations, if they wouldn't want to make peace, then you would have the regular wars of engagement. Okay, so rules of engagement. So is the Sefer HaChinuch and the Rambam arguing? They most certainly are. The Sefer HaChinuch that first quotes was saying that you and I, if we see someone and they say, hi, I'm from Amalek, then we'd be obligated to go ahead and take care of them, right? Whereas the Rambam is saying, he's seeing this in the context of a war, right? A war is something I can't go and, declare war. I don't have the ability to do so. Netanyahu doesn't have the ability from a halachic perspective to declare war, right? To declare war, that's a big debate. But whatever, the point is that certainly, you know, a regular person cannot do so. And the point is that basically the war against the Amalek is not this individual, but when we're waging war against them, then, and they don't make peace, then we were to go ahead, we'd be allowed, we were obligated to go and eradicate the entire nation, not just, you know, again, the regular rules of engagement. So the Rambam's way of looking at it certainly takes a little bit of the tension out of the morale, you know, this mitzvah. Whereas according to the Sefer HaChinuch, any person, right, according to the Sefer HaChinuch, if some guy, a Maliki 7-year-old girl, knocks on your door and says, hey, I'd like to convert. According to the Sefer HaChinuch, I'm sorry for being so crude, would say, you're obligated to kill her, right? According to the Rambam, of course, you take her in. Of course, there's no question about it. And if the entire tribe of Amalek wants to go and convert, you'd also take them in, right? And if they don't even forget converting, if they say we want to keep the Noahide laws, which means we will not murder and steal, et cetera, we also don't kill them, right? So it's a very different approach, right? Whereas Sefer HaChinuch says there's no qualifications, not part of a war. It's this individual, unique mitzvah with Amalek. The Rambam understands, and no, if any of them demonstrate morality, if any of them demonstrate that they're going to live by a basic moral code, then we would completely leave them alone. So I think before we even go further, it's important that we recognize, at least according to the Rambam, the question of the morality of killing Amalek, while it still exists, it's still a little bit unsettling that we're to go ahead and kill men, women, and children, but it's in a very specific circumstance. It's not all the time. Okay, yes.
But when he puts the seven nations and Amalek together, those were specific peoples that were identifiable at that time.
Correct.
And we can't identify
Correct.
Any of those people anymore.
Correct. The next line in the Rambam, or the next lines of the Rambam, writes, nowadays, when all the nations have been moved all around, we have no idea who's from, no one person can say, I'm from Amalek. And therefore, practically speaking, there is no application of this mitzvah. No one could come along and say, I'm from Amalek. We won't believe you. We have no way. So practically speaking, this mitzvah does not exist today, at least according to the vast majority of commentators. That said, we do make a big fuss about Amalek. Right, we're going to have a whole parsha dedicated. We're going to have a whole Shabbos dedicated to Amalek. All right, the Shabbos before Purim, we have something called Parsha Zachar, where we read the passage of Amalek. So we make a big fuss about it. So it must be that there's something still relevant to us, even if practically we can't go about it. So I think I just want to first point out that, again, you know, the question, which is a fair question, of the fact that this keeps us unsettled about the fact that we're asked to commit some form of genocide, it's limited in its scope. It's certainly not practical today, but it's also very limited in its scope. That said, why do we still remember Amalek every year? So this is a beautiful, it's an eye-opening passage from Rabbi Lam, which I think is incredibly important. So says Rabbi Lam like this. Hatred is poisonous. The tolerance of evil is equally harmful. Okay, enter Amalek. This is actually, I think that was my summary. That's not him. Here's where he starts. Reserve our actual living hatred for the unusually hateful individuals who commit historic crimes and whose malice is monstrous and premeditated. Anti-Semites who wish to destroy all the Jewish people. Monsters who seek sadistically to wipe out whole populations. Such people remain deserving on purely moral grounds of actual contempt and hatred. And of course, we are always bidden to release our hatred against the symbols of evil. This is the basic motif of the commandment to read the biblical portion of Amalek and to observe the festival of Purim. I want to teach my children to hate as well as to love. Rabbi Lam used to like, you know, catch people, like shake people out of their preconceived notions, right? I want to teach my children to hate as well as to love. I want them to know that there is a moral law which requires that those who have placed themselves outside morality deserve not our love, but our contempt. I want my children to have available for themselves with the psychological relief in hating those who deserve it, so that they can relate to all others constructively and lovingly. I want them to be halachic Jews, and thus to handle hatred with extreme circumspection and caution and great care, and so in effect they will hate without hurt and express their innate hostility toward evil by stamping and stomping and groggering Haman. By restricting our hatred to evil and those who personify it and symbolize by chanting the commandment to obliterate Amalek and by hissing and booing at the mention of Haman's name, we shall learn to act lovingly to all God's creatures. He actually writes this in the beginning of the piece, now I'm just remembering, was there was a rabbi, an unorthodox rabbi, who was arguing that the whole notion of the graggers around Haman was not a Jewish value. It was what are we doing? You know, we shouldn't be so hateful. The notion of stamping out. And he says, no more graggers. We shouldn't be graggering Haman, right? And what's Rabbi Lam's point? Rabbi Lam's point is that we have, that hate is important. Why is hate important? Hate is important because we believe in a moral code. And if you believe in a moral code, then there are people who step beyond that, right? In other words, it's only in a world of like absolute moral relativism where you say every opinion is okay, right? Is that true? Every opinion is okay? A person can have the most sadistic and most immoral type of opinions. We'll say, oh, live and let live, it's okay. There's something immoral about that. It's not a moral, I would argue, Judaism would argue, that's not a moral view. Yes, Judaism is very open and accepts and acknowledges many viewpoints, but there are limits. There are limits and there are things which step beyond the pale. And it's important, right? The pasuk says, Ohavei Hashem, sinura. Those who love God hate evil. You can't just love. Like, there has to be, like, if someone, right, let's just make it very personal. If you have a child or a spouse and someone, you know, when someone is objectively doing something which is hurting the child or whatever it's going to be, I love them? No, they're doing something immoral. They're doing something wrong. And I'm angry at the person. I despise the person. I hate them, right? It's important, he says, that we have a capacity to hate. And it's meant, God gave us this capacity, and it's meant to be channeled towards things that are worthy of our hatred, i.e. personification of evil. So yes, while Amalek may not exist today, While Amalek may not exist today, there certainly are individuals or groups of people who act in a totally immoral fashion, and it's okay to hate them. It's backward to say, no, ceasefire, don't hurt them, don't hurt them, it's okay. Like, no, if someone does something totally immoral, it's important that we feel that it's a appropriate feeling to feel anger and hatred towards those who perpetrate evil. And if we don't do so, there's something flawed within us, right? It's not such a 21st century way of speaking. We're very into love and peace, but it's not always true. It's not always true. And that's, a very bold and important point that Rabbi Lam is making over here about the importance of remembering Amalek, not for the practical Amalek, but yeah, when you have a group of people like Hamas who are going ahead and committing atrocious actions, not waging war, okay, or it'd be difficult, but doing things which are completely, completely immoral by all standards, then it is appropriate to feel that sense of anger and hatred towards them. Okay. That's one point that I want to bring out, and then another piece which about what morality itself means. You know, the premise of this entire question is that of this challenge is to say that I know what's moral from my kishkas, from my heart, and therefore what the Torah is saying is somewhat troubling. Okay, so there's really two viewpoints which I want to share with you. One is from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who writes as follows. He says, at one point during my late teens, I was troubled by certain ethical questions concerning the destruction of Amalek. I then recalled having recently read that Rabbi Chaim Brisker would awaken nightly to see if someone hadn't placed a foundling at his doorstep. A foundling is another way of saying Rabbi Chaim Brisker, who was one of the leading scholars of Torah, of Judaism in Europe and the world, his house was open all the time. It was known to be like an open house. People, they say that when you wanted to advertise like a sale for something, you used to put signs up in his house. Like his students once jokingly asked him, why do you even bother having doors since they're always open? And whatever, he gave a very Rav Chaim Brisker answer. He said, if there's no door, then I wouldn't be able to put a mezuzah. You know, I wouldn't be able to say a bracha. You know, it's when you put it, parenthetically, a good thing to know. When you're putting up a mezuzah, there are doorways you still have to put a mezuzah, but you only say a bracha if it's a doorway that has a door. So he says, I want to say the bracha. Okay, this is his like a halachic answer. But the point is that he'd wake up in the middle of the night to see maybe someone left a baby outside of his house, right? That level of sensitivity, that level of warmth, that level of care. He says, I knew that I slept quite soundly. And I concluded that if such a paragon of kindness coped with these laws, evidently the source of my anxiety did not lie in my greater sensitivity, but in my weaker faith. And I set myself to enhancing it. Okay, so Rav Lichtenstein over here, and this is something which he talks about a bit, a lot I should say, and that is that this notion of, you know, he acknowledges on the one hand this morality that exists independent of the laws of the Torah. Okay, and another piece Rav Lichtenstein lays out, he says, you know, there are those who argue that the Torah is the only source of morality. Only when there's a mitzvah, then you know about morality. What's the proof that that's not the case? So Rav Lichtenstein points out, and others point out, look at the book of Bereishis, right? They'll look at the story of the flood. Right? Everyone dies in the flood. Why did they die? Because they stole, they acted immorally. Did they have a Torah? No. Why were they guilty? They're guilty because a human being should have certain basic things that we should understand on our own are immoral. Right? So Rav Lichtenstein gives a lot of credit, a lot of weight to his own moral compass, and he struggles with it, and he speaks the struggle. So he says, you know, I was very bothered by it. Then he said, okay, but I recognize that maybe there's something lacking in me. And therefore, I just had to, you know, I had to close down my own moral compass and to just say, okay, I believe in God. That's one way of looking at this mitzvah, saying, okay, I believe in God. But says Rabbi Dr. Wurzberger, another fascinating approach, he says like this, it would be the height of arrogance to challenge the validity of an explicit divine imperative on the ground that it runs counter to our own ethical intuitions. Okay, so what he does in that opening sentence is he blows out of the water Rav Lichtenstein's approach. Rav Lichtenstein says, it's valid for me to question things which don't seem to line up with my inner intuition because I have a valid viewpoint. Dr. Wurzberger is saying, what are you talking about? If God says it, who in the world do you think you are that you can even begin to question it, right? You see, they're coming from a very different place. They both ultimately believe in God. They both ultimately believe the Torah is a source of morality. One opinion says, my view is still an important view of what is moral, what is not moral. Rabbi Wurzberger is saying, what are you talking about? If God says it, what chutzpah, what audacity? He's saying, are you sure it's moral? Really? Who gives you the right to ask that? He says, Judaism has no need for the Kierkegaardian doctrine of the suspension of the ethical, which demands that whenever moral imperatives clash with religious commandments, we must subordinate our ethical concerns to the higher authority of the religious. What he's referring to is a very famous piece about the Kedas Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, where Avram, so to speak, suspends his belief, his moral compass for faith, right? Right? So the way Kierkegaard lays out the story of the Akedah, he's a big Christian thinker. He says that Avram understood it was immoral to go ahead and kill Yitzhak. Right? How could I do so? But faith demands of us to say, even though I know it's immoral, I'm going to believe in God. Right? That is the approach taken by Kierkegaard. Says Dr. Rabbi Wurzberger, he says, what are you talking about? He says, that's not a Jewish approach. He says, a Jewish approach is not that I'm saying, I believe this is moral and I'm going to have faith in God and therefore I suspend my moral judgments. He says, no, we don't do that. Once God is defined as the supreme moral authority, obedience to divine imperatives emerges as the highest ethical duty. We say, no, we believe that God is a source of ethics. If God is a source of ethics, it's not me saying, I'm going to suspend morality because I have faith. No, I'm doing what's ethical because God defined it as ethical, right? You see that? It's a subtle but a very important difference. Thus, Avram's readiness to sacrifice Yitzhak cannot be invoked as a paradigm of the suspension of the ethical. On the contrary, it was a perfectly moral act. Obedience to an omniscient and omnibenevolent God must, by definition, yield the greatest possible good, even if our limited intellectual capacities prevent us from seeing how and why. Okay, I love a little bit of philosophy. I apologize if this is whatever, but this is such an important idea. Again, Rabbi Lichtenstein is saying, I have a good sense of what's right and wrong, but sometimes I allow my faith overrides that. And this is essentially an approach laid out by Kierkegaard and other religious thinkers that my intuition is correct. There's something value. I could trust my intuition, but faith says sometimes I have to shut it down. That's what a person of faith does, that I think this doesn't make sense to me. We face mitzvahs sometimes where it seems like, you know, I don't know, sometimes there are shilas where like my own moral compass is like, I have whatever, I feel like this doesn't seem right, but halacha is halacha, this is what I have to do, and we just do it, right? And so that's faith overriding morality. Rabbi Wurzberger is arguing that we're looking at it wrong if that's what we're doing. What he's saying is that, no, it's not faith overriding morality, it's reorienting ourselves and saying, you know what morality is? Morality is whatever God says it is. That's not faith overriding morality. It's basically saying, no, I believe that God is the source of morality. And if he says this is the right thing to do, then we do it. Not out of faith, but out of a belief in morality and God is the source of morality. Right? So again, looking at the Akedah, you have two different perspectives of what's going through Avram's mind. One is, I believe in God and therefore I'm going to do what's otherwise immoral. Or you have Rabbi Wurzberger's approach saying, no, I believe in God and therefore I'm going to do what is moral because this is what God is telling me is moral. See the difference? I think it's an important difference. Question? Comment? No? No. Okay. Okay. So right, there's a debate is when we have mitzvahs like this and we go along with it, is it an act of faith or is what I would call is an act of humility, right? That's the way I would frame it. Is it an act of faith saying, I don't understand it, but I believe in God? Or is it saying, like I could say it's immoral, but I believe in God, act of faith? Or is the act of humility saying, I don't really, like the same way I don't know, like really complex or even simple math equations, I also don't know all the extent of morality. And therefore, I'm humble enough to say, God, you understand things, I don't. And I humble myself to God's moral compass, so to speak. Yes?
My new thing, and I'm going to tell you all, you don't have to wait till 90 to get like this.
Okay.
I do not worry. If I worried, it wouldn't help the person I'm worried about. If I worried, it wouldn't help me. There's only one way. You pray. And it has stopped me. People don't understand that I don't worry. Years ago, my mother used to say, a horse doesn't worry, a cow doesn't worry. I don't believe that. I do not worry. My kids live in Israel. I do not worry about them. I love talking to them. I love hearing good things, and I pray for them. But worry is not one of my things anymore. Do it now. Don't wait till you get old and get wrinkles. That does wrinkles.
Okay. Estelle, thank you always for grounding us and giving us good direction. Thank you.
Good thing not to worry.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So let's just summarize. Thank you for that important. Not to worry because we believe in God, right? God runs the world ultimately, right? Exactly. He will. He will. He will. So let's quickly summarize Amalek. Amalek is complicated. This passage is complicated. So let's quickly summarize. First of all, we have to understand Amalek truly acted in the most immoral fashion. This is not a regular war. Most wars are some level of defense, some level of even, and not even, sometimes you're going to have a preemptive defensive war. I'm afraid you're going to attack me, I'll go and attack you. I'm afraid, etc. This is nothing like that. This is completely abnormal. Imagine traveling. It wasn't even a war of conquest. Again, the Jewish people weren't, they were in the desert. It was free lands, right? It's one thing if you're Napoleon, you want to conquer the world. Okay, you're arrogant, whatever. Fine, but this is nothing. This is completely an aberration. This is the most bizarre war. Amalek was attacking. Well, not bizarre. You have other religious wars throughout history. This is a war of which has nothing to do with conquest, nothing to do with pride. It's basically whatever the Jewish people represent, we don't like. That's where it came from. So we certainly see Amalek as a paradigm of evil. They're the ones who wanted to inject a certain sense of cynicism in the world, right? Everyone's so, the Jews are hot stuff, and they say, they're not so hot. We're jumping into the pool. So they are representing to us this extreme evil, extreme immorality, right? So there is a mitzvah, therefore, to go ahead and Timcha Ezecha Amalek, to erase them. The question is, what are the parameters? The Sefer HaChinuch says each person is commanded to go and kill an Amaleki. The Rambam's approach says, no, it's part of the context of a war. In the context of a war, there are rules of engagement. First, you have to offer them peace. First, you have to give them the chance to accept the Noahide laws. It's certainly not a racial genocidal war, because if they were to either A, convert, or even B, maintain their faith, you know, but still say, I'm going to at least, you know, keep some basic level of morality, then there would not be a war against them. So there's a debate about the parameters. Again, Sefer Chinuch in the more quote-unquote extreme view, the Rambam in a view which makes it very, very limited. And even between both those views, practically we don't really have an Amalek today. So why do we still focus on this? Because it teaches us very important lessons. It teaches us, as Rabbi Lam says, that we need to remind ourselves that there are people in the world, even though we will not go ahead. We don't say, this person's Amalek and we're going to go ahead and kill them. That's not our approach. But certainly in the sense of the feeling of hatred that we should have towards those who perpetrate true evil, it is our obligation to feel a sense of hatred, just like we need to feel love. You need to feel the full gamut. You know, you close any emotions, it's not healthy. And we have a capacity for hate, but it has to be directed towards the right things, not to the person who cut us off on the highway, but to Amalek, to people who are acting in a totally immoral fashion. And the mitzvah itself, even it's, you know, the mitzvah itself, when we think about this mitzvah, it's also an opportunity to either A, according to one approach, grow in our faith, say, I have moral intuition, but I believe. Or to say, I'm humble, I don't even have full moral capacity, I need to grow in my understanding of morality, as evidenced by the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek, the destruction of Amalek. Okay, hopefully it was a little philosophical today, and we'll pick up next week.